Monday, January 10, 1994. Grant Bulltail and Stuart Connor are at the Crowley Law Firm office and tape recording after lunch. Grant, go right ahead.
I'm interested in commenting about everyday life of the Coen Gangs during pre-reservation times. It seems like whenever anybody writes an article about the Crows, they always write about the Klan system, the political arena, and their relationship with the U.S. government. And I think these have been beaten to death. And, everyday life was more interesting. In fact, it was more dramatic, and there was a lot of adventure in it. Sometimes there was a lot more adventure than sometimes a war party. I want to talk about some hunting stories that my grandfather Kumsevred told me, and also birds all over the ground, my dad's grandfather on his mother's side, and then also a hunting story that Punicu had told my dad. And these kind of show, you know, how vigorous and how strenuous their life was, just their everyday struggle to survive. From any story that is ever written or about the Crows by non-Indians, it seems like they always make it seem like it was all play and no work, but there was a lot of work. Hunting to the non-Indians is pleasure, but to the Crow who had to make their living hunting, it was hard work. If he had to do it all the time in order to survive, then it becomes work, especially when it's really cold, when it's about 20, 30 below, and you have to butcher a full-grown buffalo, then this is one of the hardest work that I know, and it can be very dangerous. The Crows like to enjoy life. They like to do things that are enjoyable and to make life pleasant. So everyday life, the camp broke early in the morning, right at sunrise, or a little before sunrise. All the people would get up as a camp crier went around and woke everybody up. And then everybody got out of their beds and rolled up their beds, which was made of buffalo ropes, and the backrest made out of willow sticks. They were all packed together, and this was done in a matter of minutes. Everything was packed, and they had parfletches for food and for smaller articles that they could put in and then thrown on a horse. And all this is done quickly and very expeditiously. To the well-trained women, it only took a matter of from 10 to 20 minutes to get the teepee down and get everything packed and packed on a horse and ready to go. And sometimes there were people who liked to sleep in, and sometimes when the camp was on the move and maybe a young person wanted to sleep in, they would strike the camp and put the tent teepee down and put everything on a horse, and they would leave the young man sleeping there. Sometimes this happened in order to teach him a lesson, you know, that you have to be an early riser in order to survive, and sometimes this was done. But everybody got up all at the same time, and then the camp moved as soon as the teepee was struck, and the horses, somebody went in and brought the horses in, and they probably had a snack of boiled meat or dried meat, but there was no breakfast. Nobody had any breakfast until after the traders had showed them how to make coffee and bread. Sometimes they had breakfast and coffee and bread, but before that, there was no breakfast there. They simply just moved camp. And during the day before, they They had already picked out a camping site for the next day, and the crows did not stop until they got to the camping place, and they usually took the shortest route. Sometimes they used the same camping spots over and over, or sometimes they would pick a different camping spot. But they were always on the move, and the camp would strike out, and then the leader of the camp what we call in Crow Abdarojira, which means the one who selects the camping site, usually carried a pipe and went ahead of everybody. And usually put on his war paint and had his medicine bundle on. And it was up to him to bring good fortune while the camp was on the move. If something bad happened, if the band was attacked or somebody had an accident or something happened, then he would immediately take himself from his office and ask for another man to be appointed, which rarely happened. So there was a lot of religious significance, like everything else, to the moving of the camp. And usually the one who selected the campsite stayed in that office, sort of kind of his that position, until he either had bad luck or he removed himself from that office. So everything depended upon him for selecting the campsite and making sure that there were buffalo nearby, and also there was a lot of good grass for the horses and some cover for the teepees, and make sure that it was also a sheltered area. So all these things had to be considered. And then also the trail had to be, a good trail had to be selected where the band could not be ambushed. So all these things were taken. It was a military, religious, and also a social event while the camp was on the move. And when the camp was on a move, if somebody had a new bride, they would dress her up in elk tooth dress, put all finery on her, brand new clothing, moccasins, dress, belt, and they would paint him up and put him on her husband's finest horse, and they would parade him. They would get her close to the camp leader, and they would ask a herald or a camp crier to tell everybody that she was a new bride and who the groom was and who had given her all this stuff. So it was a social event. And at the same time, the military leaders would all gather together, and some would be appointed to be on guard while the camp was on the move. So it was also a military. It was also a military organization. So all these things were going on, and at the same time, groups will be looking for, will be constantly looking out for buffalo, or maybe there might be enemy nearby. And also younger boys would be gathered together herding the horses, and they would be racing while the camp was on the move. They would be racing each other alongside, or they would have what they call playing war. They would throw a hoop, and while they were on horseback, they would run and try to hit the hoop, which was also a game, but it was also had practical science to it. They were learning how to shoot buffalo on the move, and also learning how to shoot their enemy during warfare while they were on horseback, and running at full speed. So all these things were constantly going on, and maybe there would be a group of young women who would be friends, would be together, and they would stop to pick berries or herbs or roots or whatever was in season at that time. Or they would stop, or if they were very young, they would maybe stop and take a bath in some stream, or they would play with their dolls. They would ride ahead at some predetermined point, and they would play with their dolls. Or sometimes they were babysitters, and they would just simply play with the younger children. So it was a social organization, and something was going on all the time. So it was not dull. It was excitement. There was always a lot of excitement, like a lot of expectation, because you didn't know exactly what was just going to happen. You know, just played it by ear, because and whatever happened, we went along with it. The camp leader was probably knew what was going to happen that day, was the only one that knew what was going to happen. So everybody else there was a lot of expectation, a lot of excitement, because nobody really knew what was going to happen. And then finally the camp would stop. If they spotted some buffalo and they needed meat, they would stop and then they would send out hunters. And they would only kill a certain amount what they needed, no more and no less. And after the butchering, they would probably move on until they came to the campsite, which was probably around evening or earlier, maybe a little after afternoon, about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. And whenever the camp stopped, they immediately set up the teepees and started cooking. And they liked to have fresh meat at the new campsite, where they could boil meat and roast some of it. But they always liked fresh meat. And as soon as the campsite was, everybody had set up their teepees, then they would start cooking, and they would start inviting friends or relatives. They would cook take certain special meat to friends. So there was a lot of intermingling going on at this time, and it was also to find out where their friends were camped at, where their teepees were. So there was also the young men and the older men and the little boys would go out who took care of the horses. So there was also a lot of horses being moved, and they were trying to find the best spots to graze their herds. And the different herds had different herders, and they had special ways of marking their horses. So some of them would have bells, and some of them would have special ropes around their necks, and sometimes there would be prong horns tied around the horses' necks, and maybe a special horse, maybe a mule with a certain kind of a color. For instance, my dad's great grandfather had a coffee-colored mule that was kind of a leader of the herd, and because of his color, it was easy to spot the herd from a distance. So there was a lot of different ways to tell which herd was what, but there was all these horses that were on the move, and people were on the move, and the whole camp was moving about. And probably the mature, the adult men would select a certain teepee to smoke and talk, and maybe talk about what was going to happen that day and that night. Maybe a group wanted to go on a war party, so all these things had to be talked about. So they immediately would select a teepee where they called the men together to talk about these things while the women were cooking. And also wood for the fire had to be brought in. So it was the job of the older people, not just the women, but older men and older women, to bring in the firewood. So everybody had their own job to do at this time. And after everything was settled, then they had their games. They probably had their war games, which was always going on. The younger men were always having their war games, throwing the hoop and trying to put an arrow through it. And then there were also hand games. Friends would get together and sing, and also during the night, the younger boys would go around to the teepees to try and find out where the young ladies were sleeping at, and this was a game that was played, and they were always constantly on the guard, but as the young men were trying to find out where the young women would be sleeping, and at the night, so they would come and try to talk to the ladies, so there were a group that were trying to find out where the young women were sleeping at, and then after that they would select a teepee where they got together and sang their songs, and this was called the flirting songs. And after they would sing, they would try to go out and try to talk to the young ladies, and the young ladies were really closely watched. They were well guarded. Sometimes they would not let him sleep on the ground. They would build a swing from the teepee poles, and where they would build a kind of a bed, and that's where the young ladies would sleep. So they were well guarded, and young men were always trying to find ways to get to them. So this was kind of a game that was going on. And there were also hand games. There were hand games that were going on. And there was a lot of gambling. People liked to gamble, so there was all kinds of gambling going on. For instance, the old women had their dice game, which was made up of stones and bones and plump pits, which were marked in a certain way and were sewn up and were placed in a kind of a bowl, and then they were sewn up, and then whatever symbol came down was a point, so they counted these, and it was really complex. You know, you had to really know what you were doing in order to play the game, but that was a game for the old ladies. And the younger women had kind of a game that's similar to jacks, but they used knives, and they used certain ways where they would not throw it at a distance, but throw it from a finger and then flipping it up in the air and make sure that it stuck in the ground. If it stuck in the ground, and there was a certain point, and they just kept going until the knife wouldn't stick anymore. So that was the game that the young ladies played. And also, the babysitters, the young women who were babysitters, would take the children that they were in charge of, and they would get a blanket, and then they would throw them up in the air. And while they were doing this, they would sing songs. They would sing different songs, all the songs that they knew. And sometimes when they just got tired of the blanket game, they would just not sit down and sing. So there was a lot of singing going on. There was a lot of... people were making all kinds of noises. It all depended on what you wanted to do. There was something going on, whatever your pleasure or whatever you were interested in. Somebody had something going on. There was storytelling. Older men were in a certain place telling stories. Another group would be telling different stories. So you went from camp to camp trying to find out what you were interested in. There was never a dull moment in the camp. Maybe somebody went out and killed a buffalo and brought it some fresh meat, and people were eating special kinds of meat at a certain spot, and everybody was welcome to it, and everybody would go there and eat that special meat, and then another camp would have a special meat, and people would be eating that. It was up to the individual to entertain himself, and this all took place in a day, and I guess the job or the duty of young men from the time they were about 12 years old till about the time they were about 50 years old was to go hunting. Hunting was their main duty, so they were always off hunting. They just didn't simply pick up their rifle or bow and arrow and get on a horse and go hunting. It also had its religious side. They had a certain ceremony that they went through. Each individual had their certain ceremony, had their certain incense that they incensed themselves with, and then their weapons, and certain medicine bundles that they had for hunting, especially for hunting, which they put on, and maybe they painted their faces a certain way. And maybe they painted their horses too, or put on special medicines on their horses. And then they had a certain song that they had to sing before they went hunting. And my grandfather, Kamsa Dread, had a certain song that he gave me, which we sing before we go hunting, which is supposed to bring us bad luck. And this medicine came from the coyote. And the song, the words to the song are, "I will go straight, and straight away I will find the marrow bone." And that is the song that we must sing before we go on hunting.
Grant, I think you said a minute ago that the song would bring you bad luck on hunting.
Oh, it brings us good luck, you know, and not bad luck.
It may have been that I didn't hear right because of my hearing problem, but I just wanted to make sure that the tape wasn't mixed up on that.
Yeah, it's supposed to bring us good luck and keep bad luck away. And that is why, you know, we go through all this. And sometimes when a young man had a wife that was pregnant, was urged not to go hunting. And because of the power of the pregnant woman who is childbearing, and the miracle of childbearing kind of negates kind of negates the power of the hunter who is destroying life. It kind of, there's like a positive and a negative side. So he was urged not to go hunting because the miracle of childbearing and destroying life did not not coincide with nature. And they always urged the young man not to go hunting because he probably would have bad luck, but not find any game. So that was a time that young men did not go hunting when their wives were pregnant. And also, when there was a death in the family, it was also bad luck to go hunting. So that was probably the only times that the young men did not go hunting, but usually every day they went hunting. And one of the stories that was told me by my grandfather was that he usually did not, when they went hunting, he usually did not kill a buffalo, because that he got his power from the buffalo. Did not ordinarily kill buffalo, but he went along, and he was noted for being able to butcher a buffalo. He was well known for butchering, and whenever there was any buffalo to be butchered, he was always selected for the butchering. So he knew quite a bit about different parts of the buffalo and how they should be cut up. Whenever there was a hunting party, his friends always selected him to go along, and he would do the butchering. And one time, they crossed the mountains, the Bighorn Mountains, near Wyola, and went towards the Platte River. It was extremely cold that winter, and the buffalo would not come up into the mountains, but they were in the plains area around the Platte River, and there was not a lot of buffalo, but there were buffalo here and there. And they were running out of meat, so one really cold day they went out hunting, and they were lucky enough to find some buffalo, and they killed some buffalo, and my grandfather did the butchering. He said he had a heavy glove made out of buffalo hide, which was warm. But when he started butchering, he took his glove off, and he butchered a cow, and his father came along, and he said, "Keep your hands warm." He said, "I will build a fire out of buffalo chips, and every once in a while, keep your hands warm." But my grandfather was so intent on finishing the butchering that he just kept on butchering, and then he found out that his hands were frozen stiff. His hands started aching and he couldn't move them, and they were frozen stiff. And immediately his father took him to a buffalo cow, and he told him to put his hands into the animal's private parts, into the cow's. And he said that was how they saved his hands. Otherwise, he said they would be frozen stiff and he probably would lose his hands. But that was how they saved his hands. And sometimes they would cut a buffalo open, and they would stick their hands in there when they were frozen like that. But that was a common danger in butchering buffalo. So it was not all pleasure. It was hard work, and sometimes it was dangerous. Yet, there was a danger of losing the use of your hands, or losing it altogether from frostbite and being frozen. And one hunting story that was told to my dad by Plenty-Coo, he said they were near Bozeman, near the town of Bozeman, and they went out hunting up into the mountains, and it was just the two of them. He was with his cousin, Cuts the Bear's Ears, who was a second cousin. And Cuts the Bear's Ears was kind of retarded. He was probably his mother had smallpox while she was pregnant with Cuts the Bear's Ears. And Cuts the Bear's Ears was born hard of hearing, and he was kind of slow. He was not really very intelligent, but his grandfather was the famous Long Hair, and so he came from a well-known family, an influential family, so he always had the best of things. And when they went hunting, Cuts the Bear's Ears had a nice horse, a nice bay horse, kind of a thoroughbred type horse, and he was fast, and the horse would never tire. He would keep on running for a long time, and On this hunt, Sonny Cruz had a small bay horse that he was riding, and he was a good walker, and he was a nice horse to go hunting with, but he was slow. He was not a fast horse, but he was also had a lot of stamina and could keep running for a long time. So just the two of them went out hunting near Bozeman up in the mountains, and as they were going along a canyon hunting, they saw two grizzlies coming after them. And they both had muskets, the powder, which was loaded from the top of the rifle. They both had these. And when the grizzly bears came up, they started running, and the grizzly bears started chasing them. When he started chasing them, cut the bear's ears, put the whip to his horse, and he started running away. And Plenicoos couldn't catch up with him, and he left Plenicoos behind. And pretty soon, it was a male grizzly bear and a female grizzly bear, and they caught up to Plenicoos's horse. And they were going up a divide. They were going up on the side of a mountain. And as they were going up, the grizzly bears would catch him, and they would grab the tail of his horse. They would grab his horse's tail. And when they did this, as they swung and grabbed his horse's tail, and the horse would his rear end would swing out from under him, with left and right. And at this point, Plenicoos thought for sure that the grizzly bears would get him and eat him. And here, Custer Bear's ear was already at the top of the mountain. And finally, Plenicoos made it to the top of the mountain. And as they were going down, he left the grizzly bears. But grizzly bears were a little slower going down than they were going up. So he left them a little behind. There was a little distance between them. And as he got to the bottom of the hill, he could see Custer Bear's ears going up another mountain, and he was almost to the top. And here, Plenicoos had been thinking about it. He said, I almost took my rifle out, and I was going to shoot Custer Bear's ear, because he was worthless anyway, he said. And I was important to the tribe, and he was worthless anyway, he said. He was kind of like a bait. And he said, maybe the grizzly bear would fight him and stop, and I could get away. And then he thought about it. He even aimed, but then he stopped, the grizzly bear caught up again with him on the next divide. They caught up with him, but they never grabbed the horse's tail. And then the horse went down, and he said the distance got a little further. He said he got a little further away, and he looked around, and he saw a divide that was not as steep as the other two. And he made it to the top. And as he got to the top, he cut back along the divide and came back down. And while the grizzly bears were still going up, he came back down and came back the same way, so that the grizzly bear couldn't smell him. Smell him and follow his trail, because he came back the same way and it was the same smell. So he got away by using his, he said, always use your intelligence, you know. You always think, no matter how dangerous the situation was. So that's how he got away. And Custer Bear Ear was lucky enough also to get away at this time. And he said, when he got home here, Custer Bear Ear was already home. And he never mentioned how the dangerous situation that they were in. And he said he was using his teepee eating, and like nothing happened. And he said, from that day on, he wouldn't talk to Custer Bear's ears. And another hunting incident that was told my dad by his grandfather, birds all over the ground. His mother's father happened somewhere around Helena. They were also hunting in the mountains, and it was a large hunting party that went out. I guess they were looking for elk. And it was a nice spring day, and they wanted to kill the elk for the hide. And while they were going along, they spotted some tracks, some grizzly bear tracks. And he said that these tracks were larger than ordinary grizzly bear tracks. So they kept following this grizzly bear, and they wanted to see how big it was. They didn't exactly follow him. They knew just about where he was going. So they went up on top of the mountain on a divide and looking down to see if they could spot the grizzly bear. And when they got to the top of the mountain, they saw two mountain lions. A male mountain lion and a female mountain lion, and the male was an extremely large mountain lion, and they were tracking this grizzly bear. They were following this grizzly bear, and the grizzly bear was unaware of them at this time. He was just going along. So the hunting party said, something's about to happen here. Let's see what's going on. Let's see what happens when the mountain lions and the grizzly bear, you know, when they come together, see if they fight or who runs, or, you know, so they wanted to see. So they kept following, and the mountain lions, they were, they, they worked together, but they were not together. They were separated. One was on one side of the mountain, and the other one was on the other side, and they were slowly tracking the grizzly bear and closing in on him. And the grizzly bear was unaware of what was going on. He would stop, and he would roll over rocks and licking the ants under the rocks. And finally, the male grizzly bear got close enough. He finally ran up and jumped on the grizzly bear, and the female jumped into the fight also. And he said, "No, they're going to wipe up that grizzly bear." He said, "They're going to kill that grizzly bear for sure." And then there was a terrible fight. There was a lot of noise, and the fight lasted for about half an hour. And finally, he said, "We better leave. You know, whoever wins is going to be on the fight. We better not stick around to see who won." So they didn't see who won that battle, but they said it was a hell of a battle. It was just a lot of noise, and it was just terrible to listen to. They could not see all of the battle, but he said it was good. Sometimes the grizzly bear would knock both the animals, and then they would jump back on him, and the grizzly bear was all torn up at this time. He was all scratched up and all torn up, but the battle lasted for a half an hour, and they did not see what the ending, who won the battle. War parties, going on war parties was all about courage and bravery, and also to show that the power that might be, the supreme being was on your side, because you were using your medicine bundles. You had a lot of confidence. If your power worked one time, then you were confident that it was going to work the next time, and if it did, then the more confident you became. During Panikku's time, they speak of Wolf Bear. They say Wolf Bear was the most courageous man in the Crow tribe at that time. He was actually so courageous, he would ride into to the enemy camp, and he would either steal a horse or shoot somebody and grab a rifle. So he was known for his courage, and he also had powerful medicine. And one fall day, he asked Panikus to go out with him. He said, "I had a vision last night," and he said the Sioux camp is on the Muscle Shell River near Roundup, somewhere near the area of Roundup. And he said, I had a vision last night, and I saw the enemy, and they have a lot of horses. They have a lot of fat horses, and I had a vision where we drove away hundreds of horses." He said, we should strike out immediately. So just the two of them went on the war party this one fall day, and it was kind of a stormy day when they left. It was not really cold, but it was kind of a misty rain. And the misty rain lasted all the time until they got to the Muscle Shell River. And they scouted around, and almost when it got really dark, almost dark, they spotted the Sioux camp. And it was a pretty large camp, and they were camped on the north side of the Muscle Shell. And it was there was some cottonwood trees near the river, but there was a lot of fir trees, pine trees around, and they were kind of camped in a secluded area. And there was only one place to cross the river on the south side. And there was an open space for quite a ways on the south side of the camp, and there were pine trees. But on the north side, there was a lot of cover. There was a lot of cottonwood trees and a lot of pine trees, and that's where the camp was. So they watched the camp from the south side, and the wolf bear was the first to go and try to cut a horse. While they were watching, they were building big fires all around the camp. And they had some kind of a ceremony in a certain teepee, you know, and the people were going around, and nobody went to bed there. Went to sleep, I guess the camp was awake during the ceremony, and the ceremony was going on, and there was drumming in this one teepee, large teepee, and there was a fire in there, and there was people there, and there was singing, and I don't know what, some kind of religious ceremony, or maybe they were trying to heal some sick person or a wounded person. They didn't know what was going on, but the people would not sleep. They were going around the camp, and they kept awake all night. But because of Wolf Bear's courage, he crept into camp and tried to cut some horses from in front of the teepee, but it was impossible because the people were constantly going around. So after about an hour or two, he came back and he said, "There's too many people going around. It's hard to cut any horses." He said, "But there's a special horse, kind of a black horse with a white face." He said, I like to have that horse. Why don't you go and try to get that horse?" So Panikku slid into Cam and crept around and tried to get close to this horse, but like you said, there were people going around. So finally, Pretty Cool got fed up, and he had his buffalo rope with him, so he put his buffalo rope on over his head like young men do at night while they were courting the young ladies, and he put on his buffalo rope over his head, and he walked into Cam right alongside the other people. They were Sioux. It was a Sioux camp. And he was trying to get close to this teepee to see what was going on. And as he was walking to this teepee, two young girls came up and started flirting with him. And one of them put his arm around him, and he said something to him in Sioux. And Funny Coos knew Sioux enough to say no. He kept saying no, no, and kept walking. And the young girls were trying to grab him and take him into the woods. Funny Coos was, at any other time, would have gone with the young ladies, but at this time, he was desperate. He wanted to get a horse. It was one time in his romantic life that he let the young lady go. So he finally told them no, you know, strongly said no to them, and they left him. And they were kind of puzzled, because I probably spoke with an accent. They knew what was going on, but they didn't press the issue, and they left. So Plenty Cool walked up to this one teepee, and there was kind of like the top, you know, where the teepee door is. There's usually an opening at the top, a little opening. So he walked up and looked into the teepee, and sure enough, they were having a religious ceremony in there. And so he looked in there, and then he walked away, and knowing that he couldn't get the horse that they selected. So he came back, and Wolf Bear was waiting for him on the north side of the river at the crossing. And he said, "Let's get some of these other horses. It's hard to cut a horse at this time." So they went and looked around, and they fell around and to bunches of horses, and finally they came up to a buckskin horse that had a buckskin tied around his neck. And he came up to a Wolf Bear, and he felled him around, and he said, "This is a good horse," and he took his rope off and made a bridle out of his horse and jumped on him, and a bay came up to Plenty Cool, and he felled him, and he was a good horse, so he did the same thing, and then they slowly herded the remainder of the herd, and it was about almost 75 head that they had cut out, and they slowly moved him across the river. And here, it was almost morning. It was almost dusk at this time, probably about 4 o'clock in the morning. He said it really started to rain a little harder. And he said the wind was blowing our blankets around. We had our blankets around, and we were trying to slowly move the herd across the river. And here, just as the herd got on the other side, the south side of the Muscle Shoal River, Wolf Bear started singing real loud his praise song. He said he started singing his praise song, and Plenty Cool almost jumped up. He said he was so scared. It felt like somebody grabbed him in the back of his head. Scared the hell out of him. But he said the wind was blowing, and probably the cam didn't hear him, and he was singing loud, and so I whipped my horse and ran up to him and told him, "Shut up, you know, you don't have to sing now, you know, wait a little bit after we go on and sing your praise song." And here Wolf Bear said, you know, more or less, he said, "The heck with the Sioux, you know, they know nothing, you know, they don't know their own asshole from a hole in the ground, they don't know a damn thing," he said. So he kept on singing while they were going. And then when they got to the pine trees in the hills here, He saw sparks flying, and here it was. Wolf Bear started smoking his tobacco. He was known for it. He smoked one after. He was a chain smoker, but he had not smoked his tobacco. But he could not stand it any longer. Here he was smoking, and there was sparks flying. So Plenty Cool went up over there and shook him and grabbed his pipe away from him and said, "That's the last time you do anything to attract attention. I'm going to kill you." And he said, Wolf Bear was a lot. You know, he had more courage than I have. He said, "I'll give credit to him." He said, "More courageous than I'll ever be." Either that, he said, or he's real dumb. But I guess that's about all the stories I can remember right now.
Thanks very much, Grant. We'll turn off the tapes.